Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Gerald Nachman, who's written a massive history of the rebel comedians of the 1950s and 1960s titled Seriously Funny. Gerald Nachman worked for many years as a Chronicle columnist and reviewer, still writes for the Chronicle on and off. Previous book, Raised on Radio, which is kind of a history of radio, old-time radio. Seriously Funny is the story of comedians in the 1950s and 1960s. Each chapter concerns a specific comedian. Let me start with two questions. What brought you to the subject? The second is why you decided to set it up this way rather than in kind of a more general history fashion.
I grew up with a lot of these comedians. I used to hang out at the Hungry Eye when I'm from Oakland, and I went to school at San Jose State, and I would come up, and I was writing for the school paper at college, and I would come up and do interviews with Bob Newhart and Jonathan Winters and some of the other people. And these were people that were very familiar to me from listening to them as a kid. That was one reason. And also, the secondary reason is because this era had never been put between covers before, and nobody even thought of it as an era before, and I didn't until I started to think of a subject. And my editor said, was there anything going on out there? And I started thinking, and then I remembered, yeah, the Hungry Eye and all this stuff, the Purple Onion and all these clubs. And this comedy revolution began here, and it lasted in its heyday for about 12 years. Why did I do it chapter by chapter, personality by personality? That just seemed to me the natural way of doing it. You and a few critics have sort of maybe taken me to task for not doing it in a more broadly sociological manner, and just sort of talking about themes, what was going on in that era, and how did this comedian or that comedian contribute to it. And I must admit, that's a perfectly valid way of doing it. And I think if I was a little bit more of a sociologist or an academic, I might have thought of doing it that way. It didn't even occur to me to do it that way. Maybe that's the journalist in me coming out, that I wanted to do it personality by personality. And also, I would rather write about personalities than I would sociological themes. There is some of that in there, especially in the introduction, where I talk about what was going on during the 50s and why these people were representative of what later exploded in the 1960s. They were kind of the canary in the cave, as they say, you know, harbingers of what was later to come.
I think we all, those of us who grew up in that era, have our own idea about who would be in the book and perhaps who shouldn't be in the book. And there are a couple of ones that I find questionable. If the focus is really on comedy per se and stand-up in particular, yeah, then the three names I question are Bob and Ray and Gene Shepard. On top of that, there are other people, in particular George Carlin, who was major in the 60s, though he may have exploded in the 70s, who could have been in this book instead.
Bob and Ray were very influential to a lot of the people who are in the book. They were doing satirical stuff, very sharp and very funny, and I think most of their stuff still holds up today, even though it was on the radio, and it was mostly about radio, really. It wasn't about the outside world, in a sense. But they were very unique and wonderful and different and satirical. They weren't socially relevant, which a lot of these were, and some of them weren't. And Gene Shepard, I think, belongs a little more because he was talking about America, what was going on. He talked about a lot of people in San Francisco and the Bay Area don't really know about him so much. He was an Eastern phenomenon, especially in New York. But he talked about growing up in Indiana, in the Midwest, about his childhood, but it was very acerbic stuff, and it wasn't nostalgia. It was talking about his youth, but it was never sentimentalized, and he was always very cynical about that. And he did talk about contemporary America, of what was going on in the 50s and 60s. So I think that's why he definitely belongs, even though he's not that well known, as I say, to most of the country. Carlin, I explained in the introduction, is one of four who were around in that period. Jackie Mason was another, Rodney Dangerfield was a third, and Richard Pryor. They were all around, but they did not explode until later in the 60s, sometimes the 70s. They underwent kind of a comic transformation, all of them did. Carlin, you remember, was kind of a buttoned-up guy with a suit and tie who did funny stuff, but he really did not explode until he came back as kind of a hippie, with his ponytail and the vest over the T-shirt and jeans. He certainly was a rebel. He certainly would belong in the sequel, and there might have been a way to squeeze him in, but I did have this kind of arbitrary time frame in 1953 when Mort Saul broke into 1965 when Joan Rivers came along. And he and Robert Klein, some of the others, didn't really come along until 68, 69, 70.
The other piece that was not in here, which was, I believe, 64, so it does fit in your time frame, but I see it as a very significant thing, was a TV show, which you mentioned, called That Was the Week That Was.
Well, I do mention it. I wanted to do a chapter that would have included that and the committee and also the Second City. I had that all planned out. But that would have been another long chapter, and because they weren't personalities, they were like groups, yeah. I could kind of rationalize not including it. It's another book, really, on all those groups. There was a group called the Premise in New York, you may recall vaguely, and maybe Beyond the Fringe. Well, that was the week that was. It didn't have a real lasting impact. It was only on for about a year or two, I think, and I didn't really consider that as much as I did the committee and the Second City.
Which Second City plays a huge role in this book because so many of the comedians
right.
came out of Second City. Let's, rather than deal with these kind of issues, let's talk a little about the book itself and some of the people in there. Those of us looking back on it now, if we think about the one comedian who changed the world, we always think of Lenny Bruce. But you make a good case that the one we should be thinking about is Mort Saul.
Well, thanks. I did try to make a good, strong case for him because he has been a little bit forgotten. Bruce, because of his notoriety and because he did have a bigger influence in terms of content and language, is a bigger name today, and his court trials and all of that, which we can get into later. But Saul really defined that era. That's why I wanted him on the cover. One of the editors at the publisher wanted to put Steve Allen because she said more people would know his face. And I said, well, that's true, but he really was not a rebel in the sense that Saul was, who broke a lot of rules and rewrote the rules, really, for stand-up comedy. He came along in 53. He dressed differently, open collar, V-neck sweater, carried a newspaper, and he talked like what he was, which was not quite a graduate student. He hung around Cal and became a kind of a radical observer more than a radical himself. And he hung out at coffee houses on Telegraph Avenue and laid down jokes in a different way. He was very conversational. And he also talked about real issues. That was the main thing about Mort Saul. Talked about America. He had political jokes. Became known as the only political comedian. Although he talked about a lot of things, stuff that was on his mind as a recent college student. Co-eds and beatniks and sports cars.
When you listen to those early tapes, which I'm sure you've heard, is he funny?
Oh, he's hilarious. He's brilliant. He's not just making some really pithy comments. He is a very funny guy. But there's a recent line to show you. He's 75, and he still has it. He has a line, which I love. He says that George W. Bush wants to be the education president, and he's being homeschooled by Condoleezza Rice. He told jokes about Joe McCarthy. He said, Joe McCarthy doesn't question what you say so much as your right to say it. And then he talked about the missile gap between the Soviet Union and the United States, and he says, and all the spying and the Rosenbergs and all of that that was going on. He said, maybe the Russians will steal all of our secrets, and then they'll be 2 years behind. He could sum up an issue in a line, and so they were funny as well as really saying something.
You mentioned that what happened was he got obsessed by the Kennedy assassination, but there's a period after that of 30 years we're talking about after the obsession ends, and he never did make it back.
He never did, really, in a big way. He has played a few clubs on and off. He had a little resurgence in the 70s after Watergate when people wanted to hear what he had to say about it, but he just lost his comic traction, as I call it, as I say somewhere in the book. Performers often have nine lives, but I think comedians only have one. Once they have lost their audience or their hold on the audience, they've kind of had it. It's too bad. It's unfair, and that's what, you know, success in America can do to people. But it's just a crime that he was not heard more often after that era because he had stuff to say in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and up, as I just said, to 2003. He should be on the NewsHour every night for 5 minutes, as far as I'm concerned.
It would seem that the only real successor to him might be Jon Stewart in The Daily Show now.
And Bill Maher, I think, in a way. Bill Maher, who I don't think is as good a stand-up comedian as polished, nearly. But he's outrageous like Saul was and like Bruce was. And he will say things that go against the grain. And we need people like that. John Stewart, you say, is very good. And also Dennis Miller, he's on the right, but at least he has some strong opinions, and he's not afraid to say what's on his mind.
Jerry Nachman, I noticed that there was an attempt to balance with women and African Americans. In the case of the African Americans, I think it's pretty clear that that those absolutely belong there. Godfrey Cambridge, Dick Gregory, and Bill Cosby. In the case of the women, I understand Joan Rivers, because she came up as the female Woody Allen, which very few people remember, but I do, yeah. But you also mentioned Phyllis Diller. Was it just because she was the first great woman comedian?
That's one reason that I included her. She was the first woman to break through in the mainstream clubs. There had been other sort of underground female comics, like who did these, what they call party records of Belle Barth and Rusty Warren. You had to ask for them under the counter. And at the time, Red Fox did a lot of those also. But Phyllis Diller, I think, was important because she was a woman and she was making it in a man's game, almost exclusively a man's racket. And also, she was also making, people tend to forget this, but in the 50s, she broke through in 55, she was making fun of being a housewife and being a traditional woman, which was pretty courageous in a certain way, even though she didn't think of it that way and she never thought of herself as a revolutionary. She just talked about what was on her mind, and she talked about how much she hated ironing and cleaning, keeping house, and she had a husband who couldn't hold a job, and all of that, as we look back now, was pretty bold in a way, you know, at that era.
It sounds to me like when you were working on the chapters, that may have been one of the chapters you enjoyed working on the most.
Well, you know, to be honest, I was not a Phyllis Diller fan. I thought I don't like clowns, and she had this kind of clownish getup and the braying laugh and all that, which I thought was a lot of shtick, and I didn't really care for it much. But if you go back and look at the lines, they are very pithy and funny and relevant, and they killed, as they say in comedy. She absolutely had good material.
And you also met her and spoke with her.
Well, that's what I liked about her most. She turned out to be a real trooper and a good sport. And I went to her house in Brentwood in L.A., and she got it confused. And her daughter came to the door and said, "Mom, there's someone at the door. He says he has an interview." And she'd forgotten. She thought it was going to be a telephone interview, and, in fact, it was in person. But she threw on a house dress and came down the stairs, and we sat in her sunroom and talked for about an hour and a half. And I just liked her a lot as a person, you know. And she kind of converted me. And then I went back, as I had to with all these people, and listened to some of her comedy albums. And they are very funny. They really are. Even though, as I say, I was somewhat distracted by the wardrobe.
In retrospect, when you listen back, is there any of these comedians or someone that you listen to that's not in the book who today just aged badly?
Aged badly.
Yeah,
who's not
funny.
In the book, you mean?
Or in the book. Well, someone, I mean, the name that comes up for me, is Ernie Kovacs.
Well, yeah, as you were saying before we went on, he's such a visual comedian, it's hard to really portray him at all unless you had seen him, because he was strictly visual and very surreal and cerebral. And he was making fun of TV conventions, and he used TV. He was making fun of cultural pretensions a lot, the way Nichols and May did. But, yeah, you know, he may not belong in a certain way, and also simply because he's hard to write about. And I included three Impressionists who I almost didn't, because I thought Impressionists really are kind of a separate kind of branch of show business. A lot of these people are in the book because I thought their story was kind of very dramatic, and the Impressionists all came to a dead end. David Fry was the only...
He was very funny
in
his day.
And very biting, and he was the only Impressionist who did politicians. He did wonderful Hubert Humphrey and Nixon, of course, most famous for. And he made fun of William F. Buckley and Lyndon Johnson and everybody who was around. Vaughn Meader, who did the JFK impression. His career tragically ended when Kennedy was killed.
Will Jordan comes across as an extremely bitter man.
Yeah. Well, I think he is. I think he is. And it's sad. His story is very unhappy because his calling card was the Ed Sullivan impression. And he could do everybody. He did everybody and anybody. And he was a real, very influential to other impressionists, like Rich Little and others. But a lot of his stuff got stolen, the Ed Sullivan impression primarily. And he couldn't get work anymore because guys like Jack Carter would come on and do his bit. And then they would tell him, "Well, we just had the guy on last week that did Ed Sullivan. We don't need you." When, in fact, Jordan had developed it and created it. And it's just unjust, really. It's too bad what happened to him.
You're listening to an interview with Gerald Nachman, whose book is Seriously Funny, The Rebel Comedians of the 1950s and 1960s. There's another name in there. He was a name, just one that was kind of vaguely around, like Checky Green and all. I mean, there's so many that kind of flowed in. And you make a very strong case for his importance, and that was Shelley Berman.
Oh, yeah. Shelley Berman was very important because he was the first one to kind of talk about his personal angst, which is a whole new kind of comedy, which Woody Allen and Richard Lewis and a lot of other comedians have done since then. But he was like the first. He would sit on the stool and he would tell us about his demons, really. And it was very funny, and he had a different style. He was very laid back, quiet. He talked on the telephone. He did a lot of telephone routines that Newhart later did and became more famous for. And I guess that's the main theme of Bob Berman, is that he did talk about what was going on inside of him, which no comedians ever did in those days. They would tell jokes that they would steal or borrow or buy, primarily, and they were one-liners about their mother-in-law and, you know, things that really didn't matter. Berman talked about stuff that mattered.
And then, of course, there's the godfather of them all, Lenny Bruce. You puncture a hole in the myth about Bruce, which is that the movie Lenny has anything to do with the real Lenny Bruce.
Well, I think Dustin Hoffman's a great actor, of course, but I don't think he was very funny in that movie, and I don't think he's a, you know, to be a stand-up comedian and to be especially Lenny Bruce, it's got to come from the bones, as they say in comedy. It's got to be in you, and I don't think it was in Dustin Hoffman. He was great in the dramatic scenes, but they painted Lenny as this kind of too much of a tragic figure, which he was, but he was also a warm, funny human being. No, I didn't know him. In fact, he's one of the few in here I never saw in person. I did listen to a lot of his albums, though. I talked to people who knew him, but I don't think he presented Lenny Bruce what comes through on the records and from what I've read about him as really a funny guy.
A friend of mine, the daughter of Ralph J. Gleason, used to have bedtime stories told to her by Lenny Bruce.
Oh, really? That must have been some great stories. Huh?
I would guess so.
Well, he was known as a sweet Hamish guy, really, and his whole story has been blurred in the public mind. The obscenity busts, along with the drug busts, and all of his trials and courtroom problems, it's all a big blur in the public mind. And as we get further away from that era, the more of a blur it is. And in fact, I tried to cut through a lot of that fog in a way and talk about what he was as a comedian and how funny he really was, because he's become a mythological person.
If you were to talk about a golden age of American comedy, would you say that that was that era? Would you say that it was the 70s with SNL and Robin Williams in their peak?
Well, there are two different eras. Well, I think this era is richer and has more different kinds of comedians who were talking about more significant things. The next era in the 70s, which, as you correctly say, is Robin Williams, Saturday Night Live, and also, I guess, Steve Martin certainly had a huge influence on the comedians that came after, especially Saturday Night Live. But that comedy was not saying anything, really, although Saturday Night Live did do some devastating parodies. They were mostly parodies of celebrities and of TV shows. That era grew up more with TV than this era did, and so they were mostly doing jokes about TV and movies. They were not doing jokes about society and American life. So that's why I put them below that. This, it was funny stuff, God knows. Williams, especially Steve Martin, I think, and Martin Short, and SNL, and as you say, and then SCTV. Martin Short, Andrew Martin, and Aykroyd, and all those people came from Canada. They were great, funny, brilliant comedians, but it was a different kind of comedy. It was sillier in a way. I think it was sillier. And in a way, it was a rebellion against this kind of comedy, which was a little bit more sophisticated and intellectual.
I find it interesting that the comedians who came out of that later era all became actors, whereas many of the ones from the earlier era became writers. Woody Allen became a director. Even Joan Rivers tried it, obviously. Mel Brooks, obviously. Is it possible that one of the reasons why those earlier comedians became writers and directors and the later ones actors is because that particular generation, as opposed to the one after and the one before, wrote their own material?
Exactly. I think I never thought about that, but I think you're right. They all wrote their own material, at least in the beginning. Later, except Sid Caesar, who I single out as the only sketch comic who did not write his own stuff. But I put him in there because his show was so important, Your Show of Shows, and because he had this fabulous writing staff of Mel Brooks and Neil Simon and Woody Allen and Larry Gelbart and others.
But he also did not become a writer or director either.
No.
He was more like the Saturday Night Live people who came
later. He was,
later.
But he was very hands-on, and he would come up with a lot of ideas, as the Saturday Night Live people would as well. I don't know. I think that all started because of folk singers who were performers and writers and rock musicians also.
Gerald Nachman, okay, here we are in 2003, summer 2003, and it seems that after various ups and downs, the comedy business is kind of down now. There are very few sitcoms on TV that are funny. We don't hear about really funny new comics. The best we've got is, you know, Bill Maher, who's on the downside now, and Jon Stewart. What do we see for comedy in the future?
There was a guy who died very young named Bill Hicks, who you may remember, very outspoken and tough and lethal, and died very young. I don't know. I don't know what it is. That's a question I tried to ponder in the book. Why today, when more people go to college, the comedians are better educated, we're inundated with the cable TV news 24 hours a day and the Internet, we're all better informed. The comedy is so dumbed down, it seems to me. And maybe it's because we're older. Maybe if we were 23 years old and going to comedy clubs, we'd be on the floor. But I don't think so. And I think a lot of these people, if they were really great, would break through. I just think comedy, stand-up comedy, has become like a wing of sitcoms. And they're all just waiting to get a sitcom. They don't, I don't think, take the time to develop really meaningful material. Maybe the audiences don't demand it. But I think the audiences go to comedy clubs would be receptive to smarter comedy. I don't blame the audiences. I tend to blame the performers. I just think they're not interested, or maybe they think it's not commercial to be making relevant commentary about what's going on in the country and in their own lives.
I mean, even the best of, the best of the actual stand-ups, people like Chris Rock, seem to have lost their edge. Not that
yeah.
he necessarily had it, but I think he was funny at one point.
Yeah, I didn't see him when he broke in. Well, they want to appeal to more people, and to do that, he's very affable and a very funny guy, and I guess he's going to have a movie career. They can't wait to get into movies and TV. These people never thought about that. TV, you know, they had a lot of offers. There were only two in this group who made it in TV, Bill Cosby and Bob Newhart.
And they were the blandest of all.
And then, yeah, and they lost an edge, too. Well, Cosby never had really an edge, but Newhart did in his early stand-up stuff, making fun of corporate life and in his sketches. I liked Leno and Letterman when they were stand-ups. Now, I can't even watch them. They're doing, as they say, you know, jokes about, I don't know, sex jokes and McDonald's
jokes.
Well,
they become Bob Hope.
In a way, that's true.
You know?
They get blanded out, and it's too bad because they could be doing much sharper stuff, and they could be more important. Like, we didn't mention Steve Allen, but he was so significant because he would put on edgy comics on The Tonight Show. These guys don't even have edgy comics on that I've seen. You've got to go to Comedy Central, and you've got to wade through a lot of very bland comedians to get to anybody who has anything to say.
Stan Freberg is another name in here, and most people don't know who he is,
mm-hmm.
but of course we've laughed at his stuff for years. He's still around?
He is still around, and I talked to him, and he's remembered now because he was the father of the funny commercial. He did all the satirical commercials that are now we take for granted. But before him, most commercials were very hard-hitting and boring and aggravating. And the aspirin commercials where they show a sledgehammer beating on somebody's brain. He made fun of all that. But he broke in as a parodist, and he would do takeoffs of pop trends. Songs. He made fun of Lawrence Welk before it became fashionable, and Harry Belafonte, and Dragnet, and Gunsmoke, and even Joe McCarthy. He was able to write, produce, and act in these little single records where he would seize on a trend, a pop phenomenon, and write it, produce it, and get it in the record stores in about 6 weeks. And they were wonderfully funny His stuff holds up still. His Dragnet routine, his Dragnet parody is brilliant.
The only person doing that kind of work was Weird Al Yankovic.
I guess so, yeah.
Who was pretty funny in his time.
Well, I'm not familiar with him. It shows my age. I know about him, certainly, and I probably should be. But they were rock parodies, weren't they?
They were rock parodies, yeah by and large.
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, but that was the era.
Yeah,
that
oh,
was
yeah,
the
of
era.
Course. Of
that
course.
Was the era.
Yeah, he was like the Tom Lehrer of his
Lyra was far more intellectually. Yeah. I mean, you know, who else could write a song like Alma?
Exactly, yes.
Sure.
And would the audiences get those references today in comedy clubs? I don't think so.
I don't know. I don't know if they would have gotten them then.
Walter Gropius.
He turned me on to Alma. I didn't even know who she was. And as time goes on, it turns out this woman who married Walter Gropius, Franz Werfel, and Gustav Mahler.
Yeah. He had to know a little bit, but he would also set up the songs, you know, brilliantly with a little introduction so people who didn't know about her would know about it. His introductions are just as funny as his songs.
That was the year that was a phenomenal album, absolutely phenomenal. Gerald Nachman, as a culture critic, with what's going on in politics today, do you see any trends? Where are we now culturally, do you think?
Oh, my gosh. I think it's sort of a mess by myself. But it's become so factionalized by age and by taste that it's very hard for somebody to come along now and appeal to a broad spectrum. I mean, even in pop life, there's, 8 million kinds of pop radio shows on now, appealing to different audiences. It's too bad because there's really no room for someone to come along and for everyone to enjoy, no matter what their age or taste. I can't think of the last person who really did that. Can you?
I don't know. I think I read somewhere that one of the problems may be that the moment somebody begins to make a splash, they're taken over by the media, just jumps on them
and
crushes them before they have a chance to blossom.
Well, I guess everything speeded up, and that speeded up as well. The audience attention span is not what it was, and we don't have enough patience to wait for somebody to develop, and the performers themselves feel they need to make it in 20 minutes or, hang it up. I think when there's such confusion in the world, it's very hard for a comedian especially to come along and pinpoint it in a way that would make audiences laugh. This is a point I made in my previous book about radio. I think the country was more of one mind at one point, and it's gotten less of one mind as the years go on. And now it's just a hodgepodge of stuff, and it's very hard for someone to say something that will seem funny and true to a lot of people. Tom Smothers makes a good point in the book. He and his brother got thrown off CBS for doing radical jokes about the Vietnam War and civil rights and a lot of other things. He says if they could not go on primetime TV today and talk about anything that's relevant or current or in the least bit controversial, or they wouldn't get on or they wouldn't last more than a couple of weeks because the commercialization of the world, especially the networks, prohibits it. They just couldn't do it. Thank God there is cable and people can do it, but there aren't the people to do it. So it's kind of a catch-22.
Gerald Nachman, what are you working on now?
I want to do a book about musicals, which is pretty far removed from this. I just love musicals, and it's been a passion of mine. I want to write about them, find a way to write about them.
You've been listening to an interview with Gerald Nachman, whose book is Seriously Funny, The Rebel Comedians of the 1950s and 1960s. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.